Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and our guest is an Academy Award nominee.
Damn straight.
And an award-winning writer-director, which I couldn't have said just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He's just made his first movie, and the movie is terrific. It's American Fiction, and his name is Cord Jefferson. Welcome, Cord.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, I have to tell you, you and I, unknowingly to you, have a perfect LA connection.
Really? How that?
So a couple of months ago, my friend Nicole sends me a text and says, oh my gosh, this guy that we're friendly with, his name's Cord Jefferson. He has this movie coming out and you guys have to see it. And I said, tell me more about it. And she did. And she said, just keep his name on your radar. So I tell my dad, and I said, I guess the movie is going to be called American Fiction. His name is Cord Jefferson. Nicole says that you should. So this is Nicole Klepper and Mark Humphrey.
Wow. Amazing.
And so that's what she, and then as the months went on, I said, you know, I still haven't heard anything yet. And she said, well, okay, they were just in Toronto. And I looked it up. I said, oh, it did really, really well in Toronto. That's exciting.
Yeah.
And so that's how I first heard your name.
Oh, wow.
And first learned about your movie was from my friend saying, Jess, you have to keep an eye out for this. I think you're really
going to. That's amazing.
And then from there, it was, oh, you're going to be at my dad's class.
Yeah.
You know, so my dad says to me, he said, I feel like I know this name. Didn't you say this to Cord Jefferson? He's coming with American Fiction. And I was like, yes, this is the one. And I just love the way that came together.
Absolutely.
And I
small
really
world,
love it.
Small
it's
town.
LA, like, just look out for this film. I think you're going to like it.
I love that. Tell Mark I say hello. I haven't seen them. And tell Mark and Nicole I say hello. I haven't seen them.
I will. I'd say it's just perfect. But so you did really well in Toronto.
Thank you.
Which is tough because
was that your premiere?
It was. We premiered at September 8th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what was it like sitting in that audience?
Incredibly, incredibly nerve-wracking. You know, this was I hadn't watched the only time I'd seen the film with more than 5 or 6 people. And the only time I've really seen the film with strangers ever was we did one test screening when we were still in post on it with about 270 people. And that was incredibly, incredibly terrifying at the time. And then, you know, this was, I think, 1,200 around there was sort of that night. And so, you know, probably terrified times 6. But the good thing is that after like 15 or 20 minutes, people were laughing when I wanted them to laugh and sort of like, I felt that's one of the good things is like, it's horrific to sit in the audience with people at first, but then once you sort of like realize that they're going on the ride that you intended for them to go on, then it's kind of like, oh, okay. So after about 15 or 20 minutes, I calmed down a little bit, but sort of, I was never that, by the time the movie was over, my armpit sweat stains my belly button. Like I had soaked through and thank God I was wearing a suit because otherwise it would have been a disaster. So, but I was, about 15 or 20 minutes in, I started to feel a little bit easy. And then by the end of it, when we had a Q&A afterwards, the response seemed pretty enthusiastic and it was, you know, it felt like flying. That's the sort of like that. It is truly just a movie like this. You know, making anything is a vulnerable experience, but this movie is particularly personal for me. There's a lot of me in it. And so to have sort of the response to that be so warm and well-received is, it was a dream come true.
Now you have had both extremes of the writing experience. You've been a journalist. You've been a writer for television.
You've had a life. You've had a whole life before you made a movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is rare nowadays. Film schools feed into the industry, you know, without hesitation. But you have worked on a film which can take years and probably did. Mm-hmm. But you've also written for a late night TV show, the one that I enjoyed watching with Larry Wilmore.
Yep.
And you've had the immediacy of a daily feedback.
Mm. Yeah.
Tell me about the variations thereon.
Well, you mean the immediacy of a daily feedback on like a late night show?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, that show was where I really got my sea legs as a screenwriter, really, honestly. And it was because of that daily feedback and that daily grind. I had worked on one TV show prior to that called Survivor's Remorse that was scripted. But I didn't get a script myself because I had never written for television before. So I got a story by credit, but I didn't actually pen a script. And so I was still very, I still felt very uncertain about my abilities as a screenwriter when I, by the time that I got in that show. But the great thing about it was that it was daily. And it's like, you know, if you had a show that wasn't great, you didn't really sort of allow yourself to think about it because you were already making the next day show.
Yeah. Right.
And then when you had a great show, you couldn't really rest on your laurels because you were making the next day show. So it really teaches you that sort of like, don't pay attention to sort of like the external validation. Right. All you can pay attention to is the work and trying to sort of like beat yourself and sort of like get better than what you did yesterday and write better than you did the sketch that you did that day. So, and it just sort of like, you know, it really does get at this, you know, it just gets it like to get better at free throws. You just got to take a bunch of free throws, and it's the same applies to writing and screenwriting. So it's just, that was a place that I really learned, that I learned to write. You know, it sounds so simple right now, but something that I didn't know before I started working there, but that I learned literally the first week on the job, because I was working with this writer named Tom Ruprecht, who had come from, he'd written for Letterman for a very long time. And I got partnered with Tom for a sketch that we were writing in our first week of practice shows. And I wrote a joke, and Tom Ruprecht said, you know, this is a good joke, but the punchline is in the middle. And the punchline in the middle, people will want to laugh at the punchline, but because the sentence continues, they're not going to laugh. And then by the time the sentence is over, the laughter is gone and they don't end up laughing at the joke, despite the fact that the joke is funny. So it was just like a simple thing of just put the punchline at the end of the sentence. And to me, like, that was a revelation, because I'd never done that before. I'd written jokes before, but in journalism and essays and stuff, but that was to be read on the page. And so writing jokes on the page are different from writing jokes that need to be read aloud, right? So that is really just where I started getting my sea legs as a writer, and understanding what dialogue is like and how to sort of like how people say what you write and sort of the inflections that people are going to use. And so that kind of feedback was incredibly helpful in learning how to become a television writer, because every day I was like, did this work or did this not work? And what I was able to see what did work and what didn't work and improve as I went along.
Well, this is something. So my dad, for the very first time, recorded one of his books as an audiobook.
Yeah.
And what we found so quickly was that writing is not the same thing, obviously, as how you would speak and say it.
Exactly.
And it's obvious to a degree, of course, but it's just not something that you ever had to think about.
No.
If you were writing something as copy to read for a show, you write this way.
Yeah.
The book is this way.
Yeah.
And it's all those little lessons that exactly. are so vital, but it's things where, you know, you might say, but alas, I was not able to get, which is not how you, you know, but unfortunately it just didn't really work out.
Yeah.
You find this groove.
Right.
But that, I Absolutely. Mean, it really is an education that you had.
Yeah. Yeah. And that to me was I was at that show for about close to a year and a half. I think I left just shy about 16 months, and the difference in the kind of writer I was at the beginning and then at the end is just, it was night and day. It was just sort of like vastly, vastly different.
Just as a quick, so where did you grow up?
I grew up in Tucson. Well, I was born in Tucson, Arizona. And then my family moved to Greece for a year right after I was born. And then we moved to Saudi Arabia for about 5 or 6 years because my dad was a lawyer for an aircraft company and for Hughes Aircraft. And they had stuff going on in the Middle East. And so we were in Saudi Arabia for 5 or 6 years. And then we moved back to Arizona because we were also in Tucson because that's where Hughes Aircraft was based. Mm-hmm. And so moved back to Tucson when I was about six. And then I was in Tucson until I turned 18 and went to college.
Do you remember much of living?
You know, I remember, you know how at least for me, my earliest memories are like still photographs.
Sure.
Like I remember what our backyard looked like. And I remember what our neighbor looked like, but I don't remember conversations really or sort of moving images. But I, you know, to me, I think that it was, I'm really, really happy we did that because I think that even if I don't have these massive memories of it, I think that it sort of like was a foundational experience for me in that I moved back to Tucson. And don't get me wrong, Tucson's great in many ways. It was a great, I loved growing up there. It was a great childhood in many ways. But Tucson's also very homogenous in many ways. It's sort of so it can feel kind of small in that way. There's not a lot of diversity. You know, there's good culture there, but sort of like not an expansive amount of culture there. And so it was good for me, I think, earlier to have this understanding that on the opposite side of the world from Arizona, there was like this different country where people spoke a different language and believed in a different religion and sort of like ate really different food and, you know, were very different in some ways, but also incredibly similar in other ways, right? So yeah, it's like sort of like, yes, they're different, but also these are just normal human beings and sort of like these are people and sort of like we are friends with these people and these people sort of like are friends with us. And so when I got back to Tucson, I had this very, I think I had from an early age, this understanding that the world is big, that the world is vast and that sort of like that I should go out and explore it when I can. And so there isn't, you know, I still have a ton of friends in Tucson who stayed there and sort of like raised families there and have settled there. And I love them very much. And I see them when I go back to Tucson, but I can't remember a time when I didn't know I would leave Tucson as soon as I turned 18. Like I truly think that since I was like 9 or 10, I always knew like, I'm going to leave here one day.
This is something that always blows me away. For folks who grow up in a place that they know they have to leave, there is something in you that you realize, whether it's at 12 or 15 or 18, you can't stay there. I grew up here, where for a lot of people, they go, I don't ever have to leave LA. like you go, I think you need to leave to understand life and the world outside of this bubble.
Yeah.
But it is wild to be on the other side where you go, all right, if I want to do anything, I can't be here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
It takes guts.
Yeah. And I think that there is, you know, that was, you know, my parents, my parents are from Ohio. They were sort of like people who they were kind of pioneers. They were like, let's move to Arizona. They were moving to Tucson when nobody was in Tucson. Then they moved to Saudi Arabia when sort of like everybody thought that it was weird to move to Saudi Arabia. So they had this kind of adventurous spirit. I think sort of they instilled in me. And yeah, it was always I just had a real curiosity about the world from a very young age. And I think I think that people ask me sometimes what I think is sort of important for young people who are interested in the arts or in creativity or living a sort of like world in the art, living in the arts world. And I always just say like an incredible curiosity. Like, I just think that like, really, you just have to be curious about different people and like their stories and different places and different cultures. Like, you just have to really have a desire to know a lot about a lot of stuff and sort of like just talking to people. That's really, really been helpful for me.
What better quality could there be for a writer? It's like a job requirement, actually.
Yeah. Exactly. Now,
did you always have your sights set on being a filmmaker?
No. That was the thing is that I, you know, so my dad's a lawyer. My mother was an educator. They'd both been to grad school, and they were professionals, you know, and they were, you know, my friend's parents growing up were, you know, they were other educators, or they were firemen, or they, you know, they were social workers. I grew up in a, I didn't know anybody who made money from art. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. I knew people who like played in bar bands on the weekends.
Sure.
Or people who sort of like painted as a hobby, but I didn't know anybody who made art for a living. And to me, that felt like, well, that's something that people in New York and LA do, and Paris and London. Like, that's not something that is available to me. I always knew that I loved writing. My mom used to say that she knew that I was going to be a writer when I was in third grade, because that was the first time that we were asked to, we had a class assignment to write a book, sort of like write and illustrate a book about a memoir about sort of like a part of our life. And she said she'd never seen me so excited about something, sort of like, and so enthusiastic to do something. And she said it just took me like 20 years to realize that she was right. And, you know, when I got to college, I founded this literary magazine with some friends. I wrote on the school newspaper. So writing was always a hobby to me, but it wasn't something that I thought I could make a profession out of. And then when I graduated college, I started working at this small nonprofit in Venice Beach. I moved to LA and I was working as this kind of communications coordinator, where I helped write grants and helped sort of with donor outreach and stuff. And I sort of liked the ethos of the nonprofit, and I liked sort of like the intention behind it, but I didn't really like the work. I didn't really feel fulfilled in what I was doing. And so I would write on the side. I found this guy one day who was one of my neighbors, who it turned out just was an editor of this music magazine called Filter. And he and I were talking, and he said, you know, I was saying, you know, I work at this nonprofit, but I really am interested in writing. I think I'd like to figure out how to do that on the side. And so he's just started giving me freelance music articles to write for this magazine. And so, you know, I was doing that on the side, and that was all of a sudden a creative outlet for me. And it's something that sort of allowed me to come home and use my brain in a different way. And so I really liked it, and I started doing it more. And I reached a point after about a year, year and a half, where I was making the same amount of money doing freelance journalism that I was at my day job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was not a lot of money. And so I was figured, like, if you're going to make this little amount of money, then why not do it doing something that you enjoy and not something that you dislike? And so I quit my day job and just started doing freelance journalism full time. And journalism to me was a way to marry my two worlds, right? Of sort of like this thing where it's like, I wanted to be creative, I wanted to write, but at the same time, it allowed me to keep one foot in the world of like professionalism, where my parents could tell people what I did for a living. And they're like, right. Oh, he's a journalist. He's, you know what a journalist is. He writes for newspapers and magazines. And so it allowed me to sort of toe the line between those two. And I didn't really have the courage to say that I wanted to be an artist. You know, I think that I just had the courage to say, well, like, I'm a journalist and people understand what that is. And it doesn't really sort of like force me to, since I kind of fell backwards into it, I didn't really need to like stretch myself to try to do this thing. And also I didn't know anybody in entertainment. I was living in LA, and I knew that entertainment was all around me, but I didn't know anybody in the industry. And so that was also, it also feels kind of, how do you break in if you don't know anybody?
Yeah.
You should have asked the guy who came to paint your curb, you know, or a telephone repair man, the guy who checks your gas meter, because they're all in show business.
They're all actors, right?
Yes, right. They're all unemployed actors and or writers.
Exactly. And so, I sort of started this journalism career that took me to New York. It took me to DC for a little bit. I was a White House reporter for a little bit. I moved back to LA. And then one day I was doing journalism and this guy reached out to me, and he was an assistant at a management company at this company called Three Arts Entertainment. And he wrote to me and he said, listen, this was 2013, so I was 31 this year, and he reached out to me and he said, So I'd been doing journalism for about 9 years, 8 or 9 years professionally. And he said, would you ever consider writing for TV? He said, I'm an assistant at a management company. I can't sign you or anything, but I've read your work and I think you might be good at writing for television. Have you ever considered it? And so I said, you know, I've always thought it might be fun, but I don't know how to do it. I've never known anybody in the industry. And he said, well, just give it a go. Think about it. Think about what a script you might want to write and we can stay in touch. And so we stayed in touch and he got promoted in January of 2014 and I became his first client after that. And so that was my first foray. But even then, I didn't allow myself to think of directing. Directing came, the idea that I might be able to direct came after I was in the industry for about, it, that came when, so I started TV writing in 2014 and I got hired to work on Master of None for the season two of Master of None in 2016. And it wasn't until I was working on that we were talking about who was going to direct the episodes for that season. And I was talking to Aziz and just sort of like by chance, he asked me, you know, have you ever thought about directing? And I said, you know, I don't know anything about directing. I never went to film school. I don't know anything about cameras or lenses or lighting. And he said, I never went to film school. He said, I went to NYU for business school. And, you know, he said, I just spent a lot of time on set. And I sort of like have a vision for what I want and I can articulate that vision. And he said, you can hire people who know about cameras and lenses and all that other stuff. And so he kind of planted the seed in 2016 that maybe I could direct, but I didn't really put myself out there because I promised myself, I said, okay, if you direct, if you're going to direct, you need to find something that you feel like you're the only person in the world who can direct this as well as you need to be able to direct this better than or as well as anybody else on the face of the earth. That's what I said. That's yeah. Sort of like you need to find something that really speaks to you in that way. And so that was 4 years later, December of 2020, there was no auspices. I was just looking for something to read over the holiday break. And read about this book, Erasure, by Percival Everett. I'd never heard of it. And I went and read a synopsis and I felt like, okay, this sounds interesting. And after I was about 50 pages into it and I felt like, okay, maybe I feel like I want to adapt this into a screenplay. And then I was about 100 pages in and I thought, I think that I want to try to direct this. And that was sort of so, you know, it all came about. And I'm really, you know, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, this film, American Fiction, is really just a culmination of 40 years of life. It really is. Like that is, there is something, I think, to, like, had I tried to make this movie at 23, directly out of college and sort of like, and read this book and was like, I want to make this into a film, and somebody for some crazy reason allowed me to do so, I really think that, I know that the movie would have been A, incredibly different, but B, I think it would have been much worse. And I think that that's because there's so much of me and my sort of like lived experience in the film now, you know, there's like 20 years of lived experience that went into it. And I think that I'm a little bit regretful that I didn't start trying to make movies earlier, because I think that, you know, the thing that I think every director probably feels after their first film is like, I really wish I could, like, the last day that you shoot, you're like, man, I wish we could just start this all over because I've learned so much over the course of like, like 26 days of shooting that like, now it's like, if I had known all this 26 days ago, like, man, this would have been even better, you know? And so,
it's like when you're going to build a house, when you finish building your first house, you go, all right, I'm ready to build a house now.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly,
you figure out all the things
exactly.
And you go, okay, now I can do this.
Exactly.
Except you don't want to.
Yeah, right. But it is amazing as well, though, that you would have someone like Jeffrey Wright.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much of what you're talking about, one of our favorite things is the overnight success. that has been overnight successing
my 20-year overnight for like success.
30 years of overnight success. Exactly. And it comes up all the time with different actors, you know, where you go, I'm sorry, they're doing this story again. Didn't I read this 5 years ago, 10 years ago? And it is really exciting with someone like him because he's so good. He's so good.
Yeah.
So to have him be nominated and noticed, and I think it's sort of a perfect marriage because exactly what you're talking about, I think that his fame is coming in at a time where too you can really enjoy it more.
Absolutely. You know,
it's not Absolutely. Ruining your life. It's not, you're not a teenager. Like, I don't know how people become famous as teenagers or in their early 20s because especially now with phones and technology and everything where you get to document all the stupid choices you make. You know, I can't imagine, but to sort of get to a place where you get to have fun with it. And it's neat when you no longer have to wait online for something or you don't have to send in an audition or whatever it is, you know?
And Jeffrey brought his son and daughter to the Golden Globes, you know? And like they're sort of like, his son's in acting school right now. His daughter's at college and she's, both of them are in college and his son's sort of like studying acting at art school. His daughter is sort of like studying theater at her college. Like he gets to bring them to these things and sort of like he's really like, it's been lovely to see sort of like the good time that he's having because it is so well deserved.
That's great. Of course it is. Would you do me a favor? Would you tell the story you told in my class at USC about how you went about hiring your crew?
Yeah, absolutely.
He's told everyone this story. He loves it. And he's told everyone this
story. So I was, the thing that I have learned is that, and I didn't always know this lesson, it took me a lot of therapy to realize this, that honesty and vulnerability will get you everywhere, truly. And so when I went out to hire people from Jeffrey on down, the thing that I told everybody was, I said, listen, I know that your job is a difficult job. I know that being a cinematographer is difficult. I know that especially being a cinematographer on an independent film with not a lot of money and not a lot of time is especially difficult. And so the reality is that I don't know what I don't know. You know, that's how early I am in this process, is there's going to be things that you say something and I'm like, I don't know what that is. And that's just the reality. There's going to be moments when you have to serve as a substitute teacher for me and kind of hold my hand and say, like, here's what this means and I'll guide you through it. And so I said, if you don't want to do your job and be a cinematographer, and then on top of that, also teach me things sometimes, then I do not begrudge you not taking this job. I totally understand that. I understand not wanting to go through the grind of what it is to make an independent film. And then also teach the director every now and again. And so to me, I said, that's where we are. And so what it allowed for me was, it allowed for me to feel incredibly comfortable on set all the time, because everybody who was there, I had told this to. I had said, like, there's going to be times when I don't know, and so you're going to have to teach me. Mm-hmm. And so I never felt like I needed to come to set with all the answers. I never felt like I needed to come to set and sort of like be this kind of dictatorial figure who's telling everybody where to go and what to do, because they know that sometimes I'm not going to know where to go and what to do. And so you have to help me. And so, and the good thing is that, you know, as we went, it's like, I started to get the hang of it and I started to understand, like, it's like on the first day I was terrified. I will admit the first day,
of course,
I excused myself to the bathroom at one point because I thought I was going to pass out in front of everybody. And I thought, that is not going to inspire much confidence in your
leadership move.
Has anyone seen the director? He's on the floor. I don't know.
But beyond that, it was like, everybody was just so warm and welcoming. And that set was a dream come true because everybody was protecting everybody else. I felt incredibly protected by everybody on set, and hopefully they felt incredibly protected by me. And it was sort of like a, just, it was the beautiful thing about making movies is that it's collaborative. You know, it's the work of hundreds of people, yep. hundreds of individuals coming together. It is like building a house in some ways, you know?
Oh God. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And so I, yeah, that to me was, it was the best way to do it. Cause if I had come in there and tried to thump my chest and been sort of like, I'm the buck stops with me. And sort of like, I think that a lot of times you'll see that people, insecure people, will come in and scream and yell because they're insecure and because
yep.
they're,
yeah. Yep.
I think that sort of like that is a default setting for people. It's like, because I'm afraid, then I think I need to boss everybody around to sort of like earn their respect.
Yeah.
And I just, for me, I felt like I earned their respect right away by just saying, I don't know what I don't know, and I need your help.
Yeah. Well, as you say, it is that vulnerability, and it is so funny, isn't it? People do have that in their head that I'm the boss.
Yeah.
And I know. And all it really does for the most part is make people say, what a dick. I don't want anything exactly. to do with that guy. You know, whereas exactly, if you sort of say, here's the reality and here's the situation, this is also why you hire good people. It doesn't yeah. matter if you've directed a million movies, you want good people with you.
Exactly.
And you want people who want to be there, because that's the other, as you say, especially for yeah. an indie film where things are tighter, you don't want to be around unpleasant people. You don't want to be around someone who doesn't want to be there. Life's too short.
And you exactly. were doing this, of course, you were doing this in Boston.
Yes, sir.
Which means that you didn't have also a jaded talent pool. And that may have been helpful too. Maybe if you were conducting those interviews in New York or LA, it might be maybe a little harder to get to that ideal spot that you wanted to reach.
Absolutely. But we had one of the actors in the film, you know, the cottage that we used, the beach house that we used, that was one of the producer's middle school art teacher's house. We were just location scouting, and she came out and she said, is that little Ben LeClaire? And he was like, yeah. So we had and one of the actors in the film, Bates Wilder, he plays one of the judges, one of the book judges. Bates was the producer's high school drama teacher. So we just had this like incredible, like who now just sort of like acts in productions around New England all the time. And like, it was, yeah, it just, I wanted people to want to come to work, because that's right. the thing. It's like, we weren't paying them tons of money. There wasn't a lot of glitz and glamour. The catering wasn't fancy. Like, it's like, it was, you know, I wanted people to feel like they were coming and being a part of something that was meaningful, and that sort of like we were all passionate about, and that we were sort of could be all be proud of, and sort of like, I wanted people to have a good time when they were there. And so that was, yeah, that was incredibly important to me. It's not, look, if we had made an Oscar nominated film and everybody who worked on it was miserable the whole time and hated it and hated me and hated coming to work, no. I don't care. It's not worth it to me, you know, that I sort of like hurt people for 4 or 5 months, however long a movie takes to shoot, in order to sort of like win awards. That wouldn't be worth it to me. It's been really nice to, I got a really lovely email the other day from, this guy Wally, who was our dolly operator, and he wrote the loveliest email about how proud he is of the movie and how happy he was to work on it. It's like, that to me is like, that means so much to me, that just the people like him had a really nice time on set and have good memories about the project.
Well, I mean, I think if we see anything, especially during awards season, you can kind of get a sense of what a production was like, just based on kind of looking at everybody. And again, in terms of the indie universe, where you know that you're not, it might be someone's mom making the food. Yes. I've absolutely been crafty on sets with friends.
Absolutely. Where,
like, pasta for all, you know. But as you say, but if everybody is loving it, and if everybody cares and respect, that's the biggest thing, I think, in any job and whatever you do.
Absolutely.
If you feel respected, and that's the other part about you being honest about your skill set, is, you know, if you're saying, hey, you've done this longer than I have, you understand this better than I do. So if you will explain to me why I need to do X, Y, Z for this shot, if I'm telling you I want this, but you're saying really it will only work if we do this, I'm not talking down to you. I just want to understand why. Then the person who only wants the best for you in the film is happy to go, oh, sure. Well, this is why, and this is this. And there's all those terms. What's the one about the, like, you can't go past a certain angle? Do you know what I'm talking about?
The jumping the line or whatever.
It's all those kinds of things that when I hear, I go, I'm sorry, what?
And
it is really beautiful to see everybody who's worked in the film at different events and having a good time.
Yeah, exactly. And they're just, I think that Jeffrey said a thing that I hadn't considered before because I had no frame of reference, but we had a cast and crew screening that unfortunately Jeffrey couldn't attend, so he FaceTimed in. Our cast and crew screening was we had it scheduled for the day that the actor's strike ended. And so Jeffrey Jeffrey was so frustrated that he couldn't actually be there in person because he hadn't made travel plans. But so he called in and he said this thing that I had never heard him say before, which is he said, I knew that we were making something special. And the way that I knew it is because I could see it in the way that you all worked. He said, every day that you came to set, you sort of like were happy to be there. You worked enthusiastically, sort of like when we needed quiet on set, you were quiet, sort of like you would like, he just said that I just saw it. He said, sometimes you can see it in the crews. You can just see that they're miserable and they're not happy to be there and they're sort of exhausted and they don't really sort of like, they don't feel inspired. And he said that I could see it in the way that you guys worked. And that is something that I didn't know to pay attention to that. I sort of don't know. I don't know what it's like to see anything different.
No basis for comparison.
Yeah, exactly. And so to me, for hearing him say that, it's sort of something that I really want to pay attention to from now on.
Mm-hmm. You said that there's a lot of you in the film, and people who haven't seen it yet, and if not, why not? Because it is one of the best films.
Listen, I have a 2-year-old and no life, okay? It took some time.
Is that it's not just about this black author turned reluctant teacher who gets involved in a kind of a scam by writing a faux black tell-all book about his life in growing up in the ghetto.
In the ghetto.
Yeah. Right.
It's not just that. That is the A story, let's call it.
Yeah.
But it's also about family ties and about regrets and redemption and obligations. It gets into quite a lot of that territory, and very movingly.
Thank you.
And having watched your film a second time with my class, I got more out of it.
Well, he never gets to watch anything twice. And what happened with your film is when we found out he was going to have it, I think you were there like December 7th or something, early in December.
Yeah.
And he said, all right, well, because I have to get through all these other movies, I know I'm going to see that then, so I'll hold off.
Yeah.
And then we kept hearing about it. And so he finally just gave in. He goes, I have to watch this. I just need to know what it's about. And then he loved it.
Amazing.
And so when it was time for class, he was excited to watch it a second time, but also really excited for the kids to see it.
What an honor.
And you know, that's the thing is when you watch something and you get to go back a second time, if you like it, you know, it is cool to sort of go, oh, okay, there's that. Oh, there's that. Oh, I don't remember that as well. Oh, that worked really well. It's fun.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And I think that this is a movie that, you know, this is a movie that I think that, you know, you catch stuff that you maybe didn't catch before when you watch it a second time. There's sort of like little sort of subtle things that are in there, and sort of like, maybe if you've watched it, you know, the thing that I really like to hear is that people say that the first time that they watched it, people were laughing so hard that they missed some of the other jokes and the lines in the film, and they caught them the second time because the first time people were laughing too hard. So I'm always happy to hear that too.
Yeah.
Also took more note the second time, no pun intended, of Laura Cartman's wonderful score.
Oh yeah.
I'm a jazz guy, and she delivered for you. Really good score.
And delivered in a way that, you know, this was a very hard film to score. And we, you know, you can't have a character named Thelonious Monk without having a forward score, right? You just have to. So we, you know, when we were temp scoring it in post, we were using just a lot of real sort of like mid-century classic jazz, a lot of Monk, a lot of Coltrane, a lot of Miles, real sort of like classic tunes. And the hard part was, is that they would work for like 10 seconds at a time, right? And that's because the, you know, I think a perfect example is like the funeral scene in the film, and sort of without giving too much away, it's a funeral scene. So obviously it's downbeat and sort of, you know, and sad, but then, you know, Monk starts to read this letter that is full of warmth and humor and sort of like kindness and grace. And so all of a sudden you can't have it too grim, right? Because there's some levity here and sort of some warmth. And then at the sort of like end of the funeral scene, you get this sort of like bigger comedic beat when sort of like this guy comes into the funeral, and all of a sudden it's sort of like really just kind of like pure comedy in many ways, while still maintaining the sort of like moroseness of Monk spreading ashes, right? And so that is, if you just throw sort of like a tip, if you throw a temp score song in there, that's not going to sort of like move the way that sort of like the scene moves. You're not, right. It's not going to follow the emotion. And so
it's doing its own thing.
Exactly. And so when Laura got in there, it was just like, you know, it's really just like, you gotta sort of like follow the scene where it goes, because it's going to change emotional tone sort of like sometimes at the drop of a hat, and you got to move with that. And so she came in and was just so accommodating, especially for me, having never scored something before. And a lot of it was just trial and error, just going and sitting in her studio and watching something and saying, you know, I think that this sounds maybe a little saccharine here. Let's bring that down a little bit. And this joke needs some undergirding here. So maybe sort of like bring it up here a little bit. And just a lot of that. And it was, God, I love it. And I love this score now. And I loved working with Laura. She's just such a collaborative, wonderful person. She has she studied jazz piano at Juilliard. So she's been in the jazz for a long time.
My dad was so taken with her that we ended up doing some research. Because he said, well, you said she's great. And we wanted to know, we looked her up. She's got such an interesting bio, and she's done so much and worked with so many people. I do want to say that your next film should be called Undergirding, because I've never heard that before, and it's now my favorite word. I'm just going to put that out there, that undergirding, 2026, undergirding. But no, you really were taken with her and what she could do. And
I felt foolish that I wasn't already familiar with her.
Yeah. There's a lot of people. A lot of
that makes
people.
That to me is so, that's another thing that I like, you know, this movie, I like sort of like bringing in, like the thing about that Laura said is, she was like this, she said, I haven't really played a jazz score before. It's not really something that people request a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so I was really happy that to let her flex that muscle a little bit.
It's awesome. Again, another overnight success, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yet another overnight success. Exactly. Who's been working forever and only went to Juilliard.
Yeah. What has been the most satisfying either event or moment? It can be a short thing or a big thing that you've experienced since completing the film.
You know, it's been a series of them, and it's been people whose work, you know, it's exhausting. The press tour is exhausting. Traveling's exhausting.
Yes.
But the thing that really truly makes it all worthwhile to me is meeting my heroes, meeting people whose work I've admired for a very, very long time, and talking to them about their work and having them sort of like compliment mine. You know, people like yourself, people, you know, I was at a screening one night in New York and bumped into Paul Schrader as he was coming out of the film. And Paul put this film on sort of like his list of his favorite films of 2023, you know, and I've showed the film in Spike Lee's NYU class, his grad school class, and sort of showed it to Spike and his students. And Stephen King tweeted that he's a big fan of the movie. And Armando Iannucci, it's finally out in the UK, and Armando Iannucci, whose work I've loved for a long time, just tweeted loves the movie. And Robert Townsend, really sort of, I don't know if I make this movie if I don't see Hollywood Shuffle when I'm a kid. And Robert Townsend called me the day of the Oscar nominations and told me that he said, I don't normally wake up to watch the nominations, but I set my alarm this morning to wake up and see if you were not, and make sure you were nominated. That's what he said. He said, I set my alarm to wake up this morning to make sure that you were nominated. And he's one of the first people who called me to congratulate me. So he, you know,
what a lovely comment.
Yeah. Just encountering people whose work I've loved for so long and being able to talk with them and, you know, become friendly with them and just sort of, and learn from them and sort of like understand from them that is, you know, and understand their process and understand, you know, take lessons about directing and take lessons just about just the creative journey itself. That to me is sort of is the, it is, you know, it's made me, it makes me feel like the luckiest guy in the world, truly. Yeah.
I just have to say, I love Robert Townsend so much.
He is so truly much. the kindest man. It's amazing.
He's one of my dream interviews. Like, yeah. He's one of the ones, like, if I could get somebody to say yes tomorrow, he's one of them. Cause I just,
I bet you could. I bet you could. I just did an interview with him with GQ last week. So I'm sure he's wonderful.
He is.
Well, we know you have a busy day
of this.
And we don't want to keep you from it, but we're so glad to get to talk with you, Cord, and we wish you every success in the years ahead, and we fully expect you to come up with more good movies.
Yeah,
thank you. I'm gonna try. I'm already writing a few new scripts, so hopefully one will be out there before too long. And it's, thank you both so much for having me. It's truly an honor to sit with you and chat, truly.
Undergirding right. 2026. That's all I'm saying.
Now I've just got to write around that title. I have no idea.
Look, you created the
start
moment.
With the title. Work backwards.
You created the moment. We know where we are, and I think it's going to be perfect. I will say, you know, and you're on his top 10 list for best films.
Thank you so much. That means a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you both so much. It's such an honor.
It's a pleasure.
Our pleasure. What a nice man.
What a lovely man. And
when I say nice. It's not a generic compliment.
No.
When he came to my class, there are a lot of questions for him, and we have to end at 10 p.m. and they have to close the facility. But he hung around for a good 20, 25 minutes because there were students who really had things to ask him, and he was happy to stay and talk to them.
And it means a lot to them.
Of course.
Means a whole lot to them. And, you know, obviously it's, some people just don't have the time to do it. It is late in the evening, but it's a wonderful thing when they can, and says a lot about him. And clearly because he has lived a life, he was able to bring all of that to this, and what a wonderful film. And I look forward to seeing what he does choose to do next.
Mm-hmm.
Cause it's exciting. It's always exciting when you get to speak to a filmmaker who's new, and you just think, okay, I can't wait to see what happens. I can't wait to see what you create.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what sparks your interest.
Yeah.
So again, big thank you to him. As for us,
and one more time, go see American Fiction.
Go see American Fiction. It's a really special movie. You can follow us at Leonard Maltin, at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. You're on Facebook. We also live stream from our YouTube channel, which is called Maltin on Movies. You can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff like that. And lastly, but certainly not leastly, the Maltreon, Patreon, where you support what we do. We are so, so, so grateful to everyone who takes part in that. It really means a lot and helps us greatly. So, with that, my friends, we'll see you next time.
Have a good week. We'll see you next time.
That's what I said.
And I'm echoing that.
That's what I said.
And I'm echoing that. Bye-bye.